There is a cost to delivering high quality clean water to everybody on the planet.
Welcome to Leadership Unscripted. This episode features a conversation between former CEO and president of Nestle Waters USA, Fernando Mercer, and Darden professor, Peter DeBeer. The pair discuss the importance of clean, fresh water to the life of the planet and the role the private sector can play in protecting this renewable resource.
Fernando, so thank you for taking the time, right? So I know you are a very busy person, right? So it's a treat that you are willing to talk some water, so to speak, right? So and as a lead off maybe of this conversation, I wanted to bring you back to something that you said, or we told the students also when you came to the Global Economics of Water class, and about when you started, right, as CEO of Nestle Water North America, right? So, and we should stress, yeah, also for clarity, right, that you are not representing the official position of Nestle, right? Because you're not the CEO anymore. We should make that clear, right? So it's basically as a private citizen that you're speaking, right? So, but if we go back to that moment, right, when you started, you had to decide whether you would accept that that job of this multi-billion-dollar company, right? That I remember you saying this was actually not such an easy decision, right? So that this was not as not a trivial one, that actually you had quite intense conversations with people around you to see what you would decide. So maybe as a lead off, that would be nice to bring us back to this, and this probably will bring up quite a few elements that we can then latch onto, so to speak. So, but first of all, thanks again for having this conversation here.
Well, thanks, Peter, and it's an honor to be here. I'm excited to be here. We had we had a great conversation. I think it was that class was, I think, was almost 2 years ago now. And I did share with the class on that day that the decision to accept the role as CEO of Nestle Waters was not an easy one. You know, if you just look at it by the numbers, it's the largest bottled water company in the world, $4.5 billion, with 8,000-9,000 associates. It's a big role. It's a great honor to be offered that. And normally you would jump in, but you know, to some degree, water carries with it, and especially bottled water carries with it a lot of controversy. There is a certain stigma to the industry. And I remember thinking about, you know, is this like the cigarette company of the food industry? And so before accepting the role, I did a lot more research on the category and what Nestle was doing. And I found out that a lot of the things that I had heard were not necessarily how things were being held. And then I had a really game-changing conversation with one of my sons. And you know, he said to me, "Dad, you know, at the end of the day, there are lots of issues around plastic bottles. There are a lot of issues around the sourcing of water and responsible sourcing of water. But I believe that if you are in a position where you can have a positive impact on the industry, both on plastics and water, that this is a role that you should absolutely accept." And for me, that's the moment when I said, you know what, it makes total sense. And I have to say, I spent 3 years as CEO of Nestle Waters and in the industry, I learned a tremendous amount, and I can say the decision to take the role, despite some of the controversy around it at the time when I was thinking about it, was absolutely the right one. And I feel that it's a very positive industry for the planet, really.
So maybe picking on this a little, or following up on this a bit. So what is the role of bottled water, right? Is it a substitute for tapped water, or how do you position it? How do you see that?
Yeah, definitely not. I personally don't see it as a substitute to tap water. I think in the world you have a role for tap water. You have a role for, frankly, any beverage that comes in a portable container, right? So I would say that the first role of water is, as of any branded food item or article that you buy, is the confidence that you have as a consumer on whatever that brand is delivering to you. So if you're buying, in the case of water, if you're buying a bottle of Perrier, or if you're buying here in the Northeast, a bottle of Poland Spring, there are certain expectations you have in terms of purity, in terms of flavor, in terms of the source of that water. So there is that relationship between consumer and the brand, and that's one of the roles. There is another role of bottled water, which is portability. And portability allows us to carry that clean, pristine water with you to places where would be difficult to do with any other sort of method. And then you have some other roles which are really important in society. For example, whenever there is a natural disaster, you run out of electricity, you run out of food, but we also run out of water, clean water. That's when you see the containers full of bottled water made available to people in far-fetched places. More recently, and this is an unfortunate situation, but we've also had not just in the U.S., but globally, places where we've had the infrastructure around water fail. And when that happens and municipalities or local governments can no longer guarantee the safety of the water, then, you know, people can boil the water, but sometimes that's also not, depending on the kind of infrastructural failure you have, boiling the water won't help if the issue is not a bacterial issue, let's say. So bottled water has also started filling that role as well.
So, I mean, am I right? And I mean, this is always a bit the sense that I had that the first way in which you look at it is as more as a substitute more for like sugary drinks, right? Now that's absolutely more where you want to position bottled water and not necessarily as this competitor for tapped water. I mean, as like in the ideal world, that's not where you want the bottled water. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. It's fundamentally a beverage solution for consumers that is a 100% healthy solution. I often used to say to the teams at Nestle Waters that water is the sort of the health solution for so many issues that we have in society today, which are really driven by an overconsumption of sugar in all of its forms, not just sugary drinks, but all of it. However, if you eliminate sugary drinks from children's daily diets, there is a high percentage of medical issues that we're seeing today, like around childhood onset of diabetes, that could be, if not entirely eliminated to a large degree. And that's a component. That's, you know, when you have situations here in the U.S. where you have food deserts where the accessibility to water is simply not there, and you have many children who are growing up drinking only soft drinks, and having that clean water available in all of its forms, right? It doesn't need to just be still water. You have sparkling water. You have sparkling water with essence. You have still water with essence. Having those products available to all consumers that basically in a very natural way eliminate all sugars, all sweeteners, is just at the end of the day, pure pristine water delivered to consumers. It's, in my eyes, it's incredibly powerful, and it can provide an amazing benefit to society.
Yeah. So when you position it like this, right? This is something that I can identify with, right? When water, bottled water, is seen as a competitor for tap water, that's probably then there's something wrong, right? So and maybe we can talk about this in a little bit, but before we go there, maybe can you say something, because I know you did spend quite some time on this on the plastics issue, right? So the idea of potentially recycling plastic, how can you say something about this? Is this something that's in the end will happen, is feasible, right? Or are there actually larger struggles that will make this a difficult proposition?
No, I believe that it is very feasible. I believe that, and I made several public statements when I was CEO of Nestle Waters that we made several commitments around the use of recycled plastics in our bottles. We set very clear timeframes. We made investments into the infrastructure. You have to understand that once a plastic bottle is collected, it needs to go to a facility that aggregates all of this, that separates good plastic from bad plastic and things of this nature. And then you need a facility that reprocesses that plastic into plastic that can be used again to make bottles, right? And so those are, for example, a factory that reprocesses plastic, PET plastic, which is used in bottles. A medium-sized factory that does that costs about $40 to $50 million to build here in the States. And so we made several investments to build facilities like that, one in Pennsylvania, one in Texas, one in California. And through that, we actually created the ability in the industry to not only collect plastic, but process it and to make it into bottles again. So from what I saw at the time I was at Nestle Waters, this is a very doable exercise. It takes investment and it will take some time to get to 100%. But it's a journey that's worthwhile, and I know that in the case of Nestle Waters, it's well and it's started, and the percentages keep on growing year over year. And I'm not talking about 1-2%. I mean, if you look at the numbers, there's a path to 50% in a relatively short period of time.
All right. Yeah. So in of course, this question is why not use glass instead, or is that not a substitute for plastic?
You can use glass. You know, glass is not, believe it or not, it has, in my opinion, two or three major issues. One is that it's not the easiest material to recycle back into exactly the kind of glass that you want. So if you're recycling brown bottles and green bottles together, the glass that you create is probably no longer usable for if you wanted to make bottles again. You have to segregate green bottles altogether and brown bottles altogether and clear bottles altogether. And that's done in some countries. For example, I lived in Switzerland for a period of time, and whenever you couldn't actually recycle glass in your own house, you had to take it to a glass recycling facility in which you separated the glass yourself. But it's not the easiest material to recycle. Also, there is glass that has lead in it and some glass that doesn't have lead in it, and so it creates lots of complications. Glass is also very heavy. It's heavy to transport. So when you're transporting glass bottles around, the CO2 impact of that is greater. And the other one is that when glass breaks, it's a hazard. It can cause lots of issues. So for a lot of reasons, I like glass for some uses, but I don't think that it's in itself a great replacement for plastic bottles.
So I want to bring in something else that you mentioned, right? So they're basically bottled water is a branded product, right? So when it's related to a guarantee, a quality guarantee, right? So let's talk a little bit about the quality of water, right? So, I mean, remember Flint, right? So this, the moment where, was it 2014, where they shifted the sourcing of the water, right, from Detroit to the Flint River, right? And then the corrosive effect of this and the lead leaching that followed, right? So in, I remember when we talked that you actually said that you guys followed water quality in the United States very carefully, right? So what can you say a little bit more about this and what you actually learned about this and how you monitored water quality
in the United States? I'll first say that, you know, the situation in Flint is incredibly incredibly unfortunate. It's something that should have never happened. And certainly, you know, Nestle Waters was not connected to what happened there in Flint. You know, water is a renewable resource, right? So if you take care of the watersheds, if you treat them as a renewable resource, in essence, you never run out of good, clean water. It's a cycle that has existed for tens of millions of years on this planet, and it works well. It has worked out for a long time. So if you take care of the watersheds, you have this resource available to you forever. The reason why we monitored watersheds very carefully is because we wanted to make sure that that the watersheds, the aquifers, were in good health, both in terms of the amount of water that was flowing into the aquifer, the amount of water that could be extracted from the aquifer in a sustainable manner, that the chemicals that we found in the aquifer were the natural chemicals that were found in that region, all things of that nature. Because if you are a leading bottled water, spring bottled water manufacturer, I would say, you want to make sure that those springs are very healthy. If they're not healthy, then you're out of business. So tracking the quality of the springs, of the aquifers, of the watersheds is an absolutely critical job. And most, if not, I believe all responsible bottled water manufacturers and in the world track that very carefully and very closely. So oftentimes when there is a change in the environment, I'll give you an example. For example, we even tracked, for example, when cities would do fireworks for the 4th of July, we would counsel them on which way to shoot the fireworks so that the chemicals from the fireworks would not contaminate the recharge area for the aquifer that was in that region. So, you know, they have a lot of phosphates in fireworks, and you want to make sure that that does not make it into an aquifer. Aquifers have recharge areas. So an aquifer recharges, you can have an aquifer that's right below you, but the recharge area could be 100 miles from you. So you want to make sure that the recharge areas are staying very clean. You also want to make sure the areas immediately above an aquifer are staying very clean. And we track the quality of the water. We also track how this aquifer could potentially become polluted and how it could potentially be protected. And we share that with local communities and local governments so that they became aware of the resource and how to maintain that resource for future generations.
Did I get this right? That actually also you checked the water also beyond that strict area, right? So that you actually knew sometimes if something was going on, right? That
Some of the water
do you have a sense? did you have a sense that that, I mean, from your vantage point, like what we saw in Flint, is this like a unique thing, or is this like where your sense is like, oh, there are more cases there?
Well, I don't think we need to be specific to the U.S. I think water infrastructure is typically underground, right? Unless we go back to the Roman times and we're talking about aquifers. But once it's underground, we can't see it. And that infrastructure is aging in a lot of the developed world. And the developing world has built a lot of infrastructure, so it's a little newer. But that aging infrastructure will eventually, it can fail. And as time goes on, more of it can fail. Sometimes it's a bad decision, changing the, the chemical composition of water and then that reacting with the pipes and so forth. But we have an aging infrastructure in the United States and most of the developing world. The risk of another Flint is real. It's something that, for example, we actually, in my household, we check the municipal water source, not just the reports that the municipalities provide, but we actually once a year run our own, I pay for my own water quality check, and I like to see what's in the local water. So the risk is that infrastructure is underground, it's aging, and issues like Flint can happen. I think there was another one, a documented one that happened recently in New Jersey, relatively similar situation. So these things can happen. I think when it comes to water, you have to stay very close to the quality of the water that's making it into your house, into your place of work, to make sure the proper filtration systems are in place, to make sure that the local municipality is transparent in terms of the water quality that they are providing and the condition of the infrastructure. It's something we have to stay on top of constantly. Right. Yeah.
So I understand this, that, okay, that somehow sustainability has to be part of the formula as if you're working with water, otherwise you can't keep this up. And at the same time, there's another dimension to it, and that's the dimension of water quality standards, right? So when I remember last year, I think that it was the last talk that we had before the pandemic, right? Seth Siegel was here, and he is, I don't know whether you're familiar with him, he wrote this book, Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink, right? So he basically talked about the water standards, right? And so in the Safe Drinking Water Act, right? It was in 1974, right? So in that, basically since then, I mean, there's only 70 plus chemicals that are basically checked, right? So in that shouldn't be in water, right? Whereas, I mean, since then, right, many, many chemical products have been developed, right? So in we don't really check for these, right? So how concerned are you, or how concerned more generally also is the water bottling business about all these other chemicals, right? Like pharmaceuticals, the residue from pharmaceuticals, right? So then there is these chemicals that go into Teflon pans and pots, PFAS, right? So so how concerned are you, or more generally is the water bottling business about this, or what are your thoughts on this?
I can't speak for the whole water bottling industry, but that's chemicals that are more and more found in the environment. The synthetic chemicals that are found in the environment are an issue. It's a growing issue. And in the end, because of the way water is a perfect carrier for lots of these chemicals, right? So it helps dissolve them and it carries them into the aquifer. And in the end, we have to remember that, It's not like water is being created or destroyed in the planet. It's all part of this cycle. And if we pollute aspects of the cycle, it will carry at least through some of the cycle. You know, some of these chemicals obviously will not evaporate with the water and so forth. But when you look at the growth of chemicals that are being found in water, any water really, municipal water sources as well. I mean, you saw it recently, there were some PFAS that was found in, I think it's some towns in the Northeast. So it's something that we have to keep a close eye on. And again, I recommend that you always have the good filtration systems. Water manufacturers, bottled water manufacturers have to some degree, well, some have, depending on the water source. If you have a municipal water source, you run it through a really thorough filtration system. You know, then you buy like a purified water. And if it's a spring water, it's constantly checked to make sure that the water going into the bottles is of high quality, as well as the as I said earlier on, the health of the aquifer is constantly checked to make sure that that water is remaining of a certain quality. But I think we should all be concerned about the increasing number of chemicals that we're finding in the environment and that we're finding in water as well. Yeah.
I take it, or is it a question? I mean, bottling companies, water bottling companies go beyond these 70 chemicals that they check for.
They go beyond. They also, you know, with the filtration systems, I mean, the filtration systems you can use, they can eliminate, you know, 99.999, a very large percentage of anything that's there. So it's you go beyond you want to make sure you're checking for everything that you know there is a risk of it being there, even if it's not in the 70, but also you use filtration systems that can eliminate even those things that you're not checking for.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Susan, so let's maybe shift to another thing that's related to this. Look, which is about the price of water. It's really, the price of water is key for many things, right? So not just in an increasingly scarce world where you say, look, okay, pricing water properly will reduce consumption. It's also important to get more innovation in the water sphere, right? So if water has a price, right, since this will be the return, part of the return on investment. If there is a price of water, people, there's an incentive to start innovating in the water sphere for better quality, for saving water, right? So, and it's also important for the infrastructure, right? So basically, part of these quality or lack of quality that we have in some of the water water utilities provided is related also to the fact that maybe the price of water is too low, so that there's not enough funds there for upkeep, right? So for maintaining the quality of the infrastructure and stuff. So when So I wonder what your thoughts are on the price of water. I mean, so I remember that, this is not just for Nestle, but that was not just for Nestle, but also for other water bottling companies. The question, what should be the price that those companies that basically use water as a raw resource, right? So what price should they pay for it?
You know, Peter, I like to think of it as the cost of water, because there is no doubt that water is something that everybody needs, and we need a very specific minimum amount every day. That's just everybody needs to have access to that. but it to that amount. But to have access to that amount, there is a cost that society has to incur, and whether that's paid through taxes or that's paid through fees or however it needs to be done, it should be done. But I think with water, what is important for all of us to understand is that in order to deliver a high quality water to everybody in the world, there is a cost to doing that. There's a cost to build infrastructure. There's a cost to maintain watersheds, to maintain infrastructure. There are then different ways of delivering, whether you do it through a bottle or through pipes coming into your house, and what is the standard being delivered to your house through pipes, that doesn't necessarily need to be the same. There are some countries in the world where there is a standard for water used to water the yard, and there is a standard for drinking water that comes into your house. And so there are all these components. I think as a society, what's important for all of us to understand is that, yes, water does fall from the sky, but that's only 10% of the story. To deliver large quantities of clean water to every single human being on the planet on a daily basis, there is an investment, there is a cost that must be made, and it has to be constantly done. It's not like you do it once and you're done with it. So that's what's most important. I think it's the role of industry and government together to figure out, exactly what that cost is. These are not hard things to do. We can figure out what the cost is and ensure that there is a way to finance that cost so that that infrastructure is maintained. That's how I like to look at it. There is a cost to delivering high quality clean water to everybody on the planet.
Right. Yeah, for sure. So it's almost, so is it that people do not accept the cost? Is that why you're arguing, or is it?
I think,
is there a sense that, that some of the water bottling companies are not paying enough for water as the raw input?
Yeah, I think both things happen, right? There are, I think there are folks who believe that. That bottled water companies are not paying enough. It's everything is there, but at the end of the day, we all need to come to grips with the thought that there is a cost to delivering clean water to everybody in society. One thing that we were very focused on whenever we looked at watersheds and our sources of water is that we were actually paying a fair price for the water that we were using, even if we owned the land that had access to that aquifer, right? So there were ways in which you could pay for that water, not necessarily through, some of it is through taxation, but some of it is through public services that you can provide. Some of it is community support that you can provide. But you want to make sure that there is, when you look at the aggregate value that you, and this is where a little bit where corporate social responsibility comes in a bottled water company, is when you look at the value that you are providing to that local community where you're sourcing the water, that it's certainly not something that you're doing for free, that there needs to be a value that's provided back, and you have to find the right way to make that happen.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's the economist in me talking, right? So I understand this is an indirect way of paying the community, right? So why not directly bring, wouldn't it be beneficial to directly bring it back to water as such and saying, look, this is basically what we pay for it, right? So,
and you do. And it, sometimes it's more direct. Some of the costs that you bear, let's say to the local community are more direct, some are more indirect. But in the end, you know, you have to make sure that the community understands what you're doing, understands what is the value that they're getting from it, and also understands that you are a responsible user of this natural renewable resource, meaning, you know, you can't be in a community extracting water from a local aquifer and preventing that community from having access to water. And that's, you know, that's why one of the measurements that we had was always the health of the aquifer. And if the health of the aquifer declined in terms of the water pressure that aquifer had, we stopped extracting, right? Now, it's not necessarily that we were extracting so much that we were impacting the water pressure, but we certainly didn't want to be contributors to that situation. So I think it, you know, Peter, for me, it's the issues around water on the industry side of the thing. I always looked at it very holistically in terms of it's not just I am paying and therefore I'm good. Because if I'm paying and I'm destroying the watershed, then who cares, right? Then I'm treating it like oil instead of treating it like a renewable resource. It's some of the investment is to ensure that the watershed is there for decades to come. And in that perspective, that the private bottled water company becomes more, almost more like an environmental company than anything else, a steward, you know, because if the water were to, high quality water were to disappear, you are out of business. And in the water business, you're not out of business 2 years down the road, you're out of business tomorrow. So you want to make sure that aquifer is staying incredibly healthy all the time. And it requires, it's not something you can do by yourself. It requires working with local communities so that you have everybody working together to preserve the water.
I mean, what I like about how you frame things is that you constantly come back to basically, and I agree with you on this, so that there's a societal debate, right? So we as a society have to figure out how much we care about this resource, right? So this is not easy, right? So
care a lot, because if you drink it all the time, so remember, if it's polluted, you're ingesting pollution all the time. And I don't know exactly, but is it like 3 days with no water and you're not long for this world, right? So for me, it's after air, it's water. You know, water is absolutely critical for the survival of the human race.
So maybe as a last way to transition, because you're no longer with Nestle, right? You're the CEO of Melissa and Doug, right? So wood toys, right? So is this a very different world, or are there actually ways in which you see similarities to what you did before? And maybe you can talk a little bit about to why you took this new challenge, if you want to.
Yeah, I took the new challenge because I loved the purpose of Melissa and Doug. And in my personal family, we've had some challenges around just what technology can do to the learning ability of my children and some of the negative impacts of technology. So when I found out about Melissa and Doug, the purpose of the company, which was really to bring open-ended play to all children, to help children discover themselves, and a real focus on preschool toys, is something that immediately connected with me, and I felt very strongly about it. So purpose was very critical. As far as similarities, there are, you know, in this day and age, there are actually quite a few similarities. I mean, we are primarily a wood-based toy. Wood is also a renewable resource. And it's something that we are working very hard to make sure that our wood is sourced from responsible sources. We're working again with local communities where the wood is sourced to make sure that they together we're preserving this natural resource for generations to come. And then we're also working with our consumers who buy the toys in order to make sure that once they're done using the toys, so usually I mentioned to Peter earlier on, our consumers hold on to our toys for 2-3 years, and then sometimes they donate it to, or they give it to grandchild or someone else in the family. So we're working with consumers so that one of the people who can take back toys is actually Millicent Doug, and we can repurpose those toys into areas of the world or into communities that don't necessarily have access to those toys. So there's a lot about wood that is similar to treating water with a lot of respect and treating our natural resource of wood with a lot of respect. And also we have a tremendous effort going on to reduce the amount of plastic that we have on our toys. And if we can't reduce them, at least move on to more of a recycled plastic environment, which again, I believe is something that is very possible. It has to be planned for, and we're in that process, but it's very possible. So it's been a fantastic challenge. Another similarity is that this the brand, Melissa and Doug, the brand as an entity is, you know, it's when you run a brand either in the food industry, in the toy category, or a brand of computers, building brands, nurturing brands, developing brands has a lot of similarities from brand to brand. And here I see some of that as well. But ultimately, what brought me to Melissa and Doug is purpose. I felt very strongly. My wife and I both work outside of, spend a lot of time outside of work helping children in, who are in a situation of need. And I felt very strongly that I could spend the 10 hours a day that I spend working also helping children in a company that has such a strong purpose. So it was a kind of a natural fit for me.
All right. So yeah, maybe we should thank you for these interesting thoughts here. So let's maybe open it up and see whether people have any questions that connect. So feel free to type in questions in the question and answer. Oh, and I see one here that that maybe touches a little bit upon the conversation we had about water quality, right? And the sense that probably private companies may actually monitor water quite continuously, and also public do it as well. But so there is a challenge for funding, right? So in a challenge for management. And so the somebody submitting a question asks, could you see an extension of private public partnerships where private companies take on municipal water responsibilities? Is that something that that you've thought about, or that you have an opinion about or think about?
You know, that's a great question. In fact, some of that already happens. Like in the Canary Islands, it is a public-private partnership for delivering water to households. And this is more my personal opinion than anything else. I think that having seen what I saw in the water industry, there is a big opportunity for private-public partnerships when it comes to water. I think the challenges that both government and private institutions face in delivering clean water are similar. The methods by which they're delivering water are different, but the testing that you have to do, the quality standards, all those things are almost exactly the same. If I want to deliver drinking water to a consumer through bottled water, through tap water, most of the standards, if not all the standards, should be exactly the same. And I think together, both could be, there would be a, I think a, 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 probably better testing protocols. There would be probably better attention to the state of the infrastructure, as well as on the industry side. I think there would be a greater, let's say, acceleration to making sure that the watersheds are as protected as they should be from an industry side. And then the other thing you have to remember is that, man, I don't know the exact number, but I would venture to guess that at least 50% of the bottled water sold in the United States is bought from municipalities, right? It's tap water that's purified to a much higher level than you get in the tap, and then it's rebottled. So that in some ways, that partnership it already exists, you know?
Right. Okay. Or the question is, if indeed, if it's water bottling that do take water from municipal water, right? So whether they should get more involved, right? So that this may tie into the what we were talking about, the price of water as well, right? So in a sense that if it's the case that you take a lot of municipal water, right, that I mean, you have an interest, right? A vested interest in actually that this infrastructure is maintained, and it might actually also undo some of the criticism that's there, right? Then, with respect to these companies, if they would actually very actively get involved and say, "Look, all right, we will actually be involved in transfer and technology, or helping monitor," and that might actually lower somewhat the temperature, right, that we have around some of these issues, right?
So and just to build on that, the great news for all of us is, as I said, is that some of that is already taking place. I mean, local industry and local governments are already partnering on testing protocols and things of this nature, so there is some of that already taking place. And to the question, could more happen? Absolutely. I don't think that industry and government on this topic need to be opposite to each other. I think it can be very complementary.
Right.
You know, so, there are some things in the delivery of municipal water that some consumers, and it's, again, it's a consumer choice. For example, municipal water in many places has fluoride or has chlorine. Lots of consumers don't want that. And so you don't, you know, that's why I'm always, at the end of the day, we have to think about what is it that we need to deliver to demanding consumers, and find a way to deliver that. There are some consumers who don't care. Like, for example, I always laugh a little bit when I see, and it's just me, it may sound a little weird, but you go to an expensive restaurant and you drink tap water that tastes like chlorine with a very expensive meal. For me, that makes no sense. If I'm having great food, I want to have great water, maybe great wine as well, right? But I don't want to have something that tastes like chlorine. I can taste the chlorine from a mile away. So it's about that consumer preference and making sure that at the end of the day, the consumer is, at a minimum, we're meeting the minimum threshold of quality that for good health that consumers need. And then for, depending on your level of demand of the kind of water that you like to be drinking, that you can find solutions out there that achieve that.
Right. So, I mean, this is, I like this in a sense that you're again pushing it in the sense of bottled water, not necessarily as a substitute for tapped water, but as something that actually has this very specific role, right?
It has a value add for sure.
Yeah.
It could be sparkling, right? It could be an essence, but it's not substituting tap water. Absolutely not.
So, and then I see another question that may relate to the issue of the source of water, and I guess in this particular case also the wells. I mean, so the question is, how do you manage the push-pull challenge of which companies or governments control water resources, and who can or cannot purchase water rights? So maybe can you say something about these, the water rights? I guess these wells, were these owned by Nestle, or how was that?
So, you know, when it comes to water rights, every country in the world is different. And even within the United States, it's a little different from state to state. But generally speaking, if you have a spring site, and that's a very well regulated definition of what a spring is, and it has to meet that, the criteria. But if you own land that's where the spring exists, and it, again, it has to meet very specific regulations, then you have access to that spring, right? Now, then there is an amount of water that can be extracted. And again, that varies state by state. But generally, the amount that that you can extract is one that has been predetermined. And this happens in conjunction, local government, the industry as well, is a pretty analytical process, let's say, to make sure that whatever water you're extracting does not exceed the capacity of the aquifer. So that's, you know, that's the law in the United States. So it there are some places like in California and a few places here or there that are different, but generally speaking, when it comes to water rights, as long as you own the land where the spring exists, you have access to that water at a restricted amount, right? So you don't want to extract so much water that you're damaging the health of the aquifer. I would say that the role of industry here is to make sure that, you know, I will tell you that at times we found aquifers that where the discharge amount of the aquifer was lower, let's say, than what the law allowed. And this is where ethical businesses have to come in and say, actually, no, we've done the study, and the maximum that we can or that anybody should be able to take from this aquifer is X. And what's interesting is that sometimes we actually looked at land that would give us access to an aquifer, but because the aquifer was not properly protected, and you have to remember, some of these things are, we're talking about a radius of 500 miles. It's pretty big area, so you're not going to buy all of it, but you would buy access to it. But if it's not protected in that radius of 500 miles, you actually don't want to buy access to that aquifer, right? If there isn't a unified position by all the communities that tap into that aquifer that they want to protect that aquifer, you don't want to go there, because that aquifer is no longer a sustainable resource. At some point in time, you're going to have issues with not just the amount of water, but also the quality of water coming out of that aquifer. We also, in some instances, did not make the investment on the land around the aquifer. Sometimes we bought, someone else had the rights to the land and the aquifer, and we pay them a fair competitive price for the water that they could provide. Sometimes you buy the water, sometimes you own the land that gives you access to the water.
So in your experience, is it that, that basically yourself, you have to figure out what the sustainable level of extraction is? Or is it the case that actually there are imposed limits that basically says, okay, this is only the amount that you can extract? Or is it something that you have to figure out? I mean, do you have discretion in this, or are there like hard limits on this?
No, generally there are hard limits. It varies. It varies aquifer, almost aquifer to aquifer. But we had our own very strict internal limits and a pretty detailed hydrology study would always be done on every single location. So that you could understand, we could understand very well. And generally, we would do some of the work, but you also want to have third parties doing the work so that it's not just your opinion, but you have someone, an independent group looking at this. Because you have to, in the end, remember, your business is water. And so you don't want to, you want to do whatever you can to ensure that that aquifer stays productive. If it doesn't, then you don't really have a business.
Right. I see we are running out of time here. All very, very interesting thoughts. I feel like we could continue talking water, but I'm sure many of you have also other things to do. But I'm sure Fernando has other things to do as well. So thank you very much, Fernando, for this interesting conversation. And certainly between the two of us, this won't be the last time, right? So and thanks to Greg and the team for setting this up. I think this is a wonderful initiative to have people communicate about a topic dear to their interests and hearts. All right. Okay.
Well, thank you, Peter. And thank you, everybody, for attending.
Leadership Unscripted is a Darden speaker series hosted at UVA Darden DC Metro in Arlington, Virginia. To learn more, visit us at darden.virginia.edu.